Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hi, this is Jackie Abram. I'm the author of a book called Hush Money, How One Woman Proved Systemic Racism in Her Workplace and Kept Her Job. And I'm excited to share my personal story dealing with racism in the workplace with you today. I wanted to share it because I think it will be helpful to others who may be experiencing racism, as well as those who have never experienced racism. And so I hope you find value in my story. And I thank you for listening. Before we get started, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself. Before I began my journey as an anti-racism consultant, I earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration and Management and had a lucrative career in higher education that I was very good at and that I enjoyed. It was a career that paid me enough money to not only provide for my family, which as a single mother of two was very important, but to also pay my bills. It was a career that by any measure should have been a successful career, but it wasn't. Because throughout my career, which spanned nearly two decades, I became a victim of racism in the workplace, and not the kind of racism you typically see reflected in movies, TV shows, and books, about racism that occurred decades ago, you know, during a time when it was more overt and easily spotted. The racism that I experienced was a little different. It was more covert, it was hidden, and it was much harder to prove. And so as I was building my career and working in an environment that was horrific, to say the least, I suffered a lot of racial trauma that to this day I have not fully recovered from, as my career was repeatedly derailed and I was forced to start over again and again. I was 52 years old the last time my career was derailed, and so traumatized by my experiences that it nearly destroyed me. But last year, when both my girls, who were now all grown up with families and careers of their own, began suffering the same fate, I realized that God had a different plan for me. And after listening to similar gut-wrenching stories about racism in the workplace from others in our community, with jobs from the lowest on the totem pole to the highest, I pulled myself out of corporate America, co-authored a book inspired by true events, and began selling that book from the trunk of my car about 4 months ago to add my voice to the conversations about systemic racism that began occurring after the world witnessed the brutal killing of George Floyd by police. My book is called Hush Money, How One Woman Proved Systemic Racism in Her Workplace and Kept Her Job. Hush Money tells a powerful story of David against a modern-day corporate Goliath with a woman named Ebony, a single mother who was going through a divorce, living in poverty with her sick mother, and more than anything, just wanting a chance to live the American dream that for her was just a fantasy. But finally, after years of working dead-end jobs, she got a call from a woman at the temp agency she had signed up with just 2 weeks earlier. "Daybrun Career Institute needs a secretary," the woman said. "It's a temp position that pays $16 an hour. Are you interested?" "Heck yeah, that's a lot of moolah," Ebony thought to herself before calmly verbalizing her interest. And that's where her story begins, with the call that changed her life in the best way and also the worst way. The call that began her six-figure career in higher education and her descent into racism hell. So she began her temp assignment at the main campus of this well-known college. And things were great in the beginning. She impressed her boss, the chancellor, Dr. Hall, with the computer skills she learned at a safe house for abused women. And 2 months later, he bought out her contract with a temp agency and hired her permanently as the senior secretary of the college at $40,000 a year, which was the most she'd ever made. Ebony loved her job and her boss, and she continued to be hopeful that she would work there for many years to come. But her hope soon turned to horror after Dr. Hall resigned unexpectedly, and Ebony found herself reporting to Miss Kelly, the new chancellor. During her first year of employment, Ebony suffered as Miss Kelly tried to break her. Like she was a wild horse, she was determined and eager to tame. She humiliated her in meetings, nicknamed her Agony, and degraded and dehumanized her with threats and fear. She also took away the computer duties that Ebony was good at and that she enjoyed, reduced her job to getting her coffee, and introduced her to visitors as her good-for-nothing secretary. Ebony wanted to resign to keep her sanity, but she couldn't afford to as a single mom with a sick mother. And so after researching discrimination on the EEOC's website and coming to the conclusion that Ms. Kelly's harassment wasn't illegal because it wasn't based on any protected class, she continued reporting to Ms. Kelly and suffering in silence for 11 long months. Until the day Ms. Kelly demoted her during her second year of employment, decreased her salary to $37,000 a year, and transferred her to the student finance office, where she was the only Black employee. But Ebony was very smart, and so she was able to learn her job and perform it very well, so well, in fact, that she became a favorite among students. But when Ms. Kelly took notice of the fact that students were flocking to her, Ms. Kelly decided to capitalize on it and use her Blackness as a marketing tool to increase minority enrollments. But Ebony also suffered further abuse at the hands of her new boss, Malcolm Webb, who was the assistant director of student finance, who asked her how she learned to speak so articulately, then excluded her from lunch gatherings, you know, offered snacks to everyone but her, excluded her from team meetings, and required her to constantly work the late shift while everyone else went home on time. And after Ebony followed company policy and reported his discrimination to HR, the situation didn't improve. It actually made the situation go from bad to worse, because Malcolm retaliated against her. He reviewed her completed work and riddled it with errors, making it appear that she was incompetent and putting her job at risk. He verbally abused her in front of her coworkers, and in private, he called her darky constantly, while he continued to make her work more late shifts than anyone else. And since he knew that her sister, Gabrielle, was also now a student at Daybrun, he tampered with Gabrielle's financial aid, which caused a delay in the additional student loan fund she had borrowed to help her mom catch up on her car payments, which delayed the stipend check Gabrielle was supposed to receive and resulted in their mom's car being repossessed. Ebony once again made multiple complaints to HR about Malcolm, you know, both anonymously and verbally. But her complaints continued to fall on deaf ears, leaving her vulnerable to further abuse. And to make matters worse, Ms. Kelly retaliated against her too, terrorizing Ebony about filing the anonymous complaint and airing their dirty laundry to their parent company. She threatened Ebony that she had committed career suicide and would never get promoted in this organization. But she also spread vicious rumors about her across the campus, labeling her mockingly as the girl who cried racism. And because she was the chancellor, you know, and the chancellor is the highest position at this campus, and her words carried a huge amount of weight, she transformed Ebony from the racial discrimination victim that she was into a social outcast. And no one wanted to talk to Ebony, let alone be seen with her. And at this point, she was just too afraid to file another discrimination complaint. Now, I like to think at this point that God intervened, because despite Malcolm's best attempts to derail Ebony's career, she was successful. And during her third year of employment, she was unexpectedly promoted to Director of Student Finance and transferred away from Malcolm to the Temple campus, where she was the only Black person in a management position. And as you can imagine, Ebony was thrilled. She had a new boss, Dr. Romano, who was the chancellor at the Temple campus. She had a department and staff of her own to manage, which was very exciting. And she was given a whopping salary of $55,000 a year, which again was the most she'd ever made. But best of all, she had escaped from Malcolm's carnival of horrors. Now, because Ebony didn't have any management experience in student finance or otherwise, Malcolm, her racist tormentor back at the Austin campus, was sent to the Temple campus to train her. And after everything he had attempted to do previously to derail her career, I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you that he continued his efforts as he trained her, withholding information that was critical to her position and withholding resources and tools that were vital to her success as a director. In a nutshell, he intentionally trained her incorrectly on functions that he himself had been performing correctly for years. It caused Ebony an enormous amount of stress, humiliation, and embarrassment, and really put her job at risk before it even really got going. Now, you know, as I stressed to you before, though, one thing about Ebony, she was very smart. And she knew that if she was going to have a chance of being successful in this new career, she needed to figure out how to manage the student finance department herself. So over the next 2 months, she worked 14-hour days, 7 days a week, reading every technical manual published by the U.S. Department of Education, taking every online training course offered by student finance associations, developing important contacts in the industry outside of her campus bubble, and developing information and knowledge that she got from people who were experts in the student finance management field. By the time she was finished, she had gained so much knowledge on student finance operations that she not only learned the correct way to manage her department, but she also acquired valuable knowledge that she was able to use to develop new processes, retrain her staff, and successfully resolve every issue that had plagued her department for years, much to Dr. Romano's delight, as well as the parents' company delight, who was now taking notice of Ebony. Ebony became so good at her job that she received awards from her parent company for outstanding financial performance, for going above and beyond the call of duty. And because of the stellar processes that she put into place, she was actually given the honor of training over 60 campuses owned by Daybrun's parent company on the processes she developed. At this point in her career, things were going better than ever for her, and her career was finally back on track. But as always happens, life happens, and before she knew it, things had changed, because Ebony's boss, Dr. Romano, the boss she started out with at the Temple campus, She was unexpectedly terminated. And once again, Ebony found herself reporting to a new chancellor by the name of Dr. Taylor. So it was obvious to Ebony, as soon as she started reporting to Dr. Taylor, that Dr. Taylor really didn't like her because she avoided her like she had the plague. She wanted nothing to do with Ebony, so much so that in an effort to limit her contact with her, she changed Ebony's reporting structure so that Ebony no longer reported to her as the chancellor who was in the highest position at the campus, but now instead reported to Logan McDougall, who was the vice president of finance. But as the weeks went by, Dr. Taylor still found it increasingly difficult to limit interactions with Ebony, even after changing her reporting structure, because she was the only one on campus who had a working knowledge of student finance operations. But one day, as they were walking down the hallway together, Dr. Taylor said something that rubbed Ebony the wrong way. "I've never seen hair like yours," she said casually. "Reminds me of earthworms." When Ebony heard her offhanded comment, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that she was taking a subtle jab at her braids. But the offhanded comments didn't stop there. A week later, she made another comment to Ebony that made her cringe during her first campus management meeting with Dr. Taylor at the helm. "Ebony," Dr. Taylor said, "you are so articulate. If you weren't sitting right here in front of me, I wouldn't know you were Black." At this point, alarms were going off in Ebony's head. She really wanted to give Dr. Taylor the benefit of the doubt and not automatically assume that she was yet another racist. But after everything she had endured at the Austin campus with Ms. Kelly and Malcolm, she wasn't taking any chances this time. And since HR so easily turned a blind eye to her anonymous and verbal discrimination complaints, she decided to create weapons consisting of written documentation and tangible evidence that she could use to protect herself and her career if it turned out that her suspicions about Dr. Taylor were correct. So initially, the thought of secretly recording all future conversations that Dr. Taylor would undoubtedly have with her using her smartphone crossed her mind, especially since she knew that Texas, the state that she lived in, was a one-party consent state, and federal law allowed the secret recording of conversations that she was a party to. But she was worried about getting caught, and she also knew that that method wouldn't be 100% foolproof, because there would be times where Dr. Taylor just showed up in her office and wanted to talk. So instead, she decided to create a document that she could use to keep track of all conversations with Dr. Taylor. She named it Daily Log. She inserted a 3-column table with a date, time, and description header. And then using her memory, as well as emails she had received and sent, she documented everything of importance in her daily log, starting way back at the beginning with all of her problems at the Austin campus, and moving forward to present day, ending with the offhanded comments from Dr. Taylor. Once everything that had occurred in the past was entered, her daily log became a living document that she would update daily as new events occurred. Next, Ebony adopted the motto, "The E in email stands for evidence." And not only did she save copies of all emails and documents related to her employment using a free online cloud storage site she found on the internet, but she also saved copies of all emails she had received from all sources regarding her outstanding performance and the award she had won as proof that she was performing her job at a very high level before Dr. Taylor came into the picture and she began reporting to her. This was important because when Malcolm retaliated against her for filing the anonymous discrimination complaint, he changed her work she had completed, remember that? And riddled it with errors to make it appear that she was an incompetent employee, so he could justify writing her up and firing her. By saving the emails pertaining to her outstanding performance and the award she had won along the way, she had tangible proof that she was not only an outstanding employee, but was also an employee who was recognized for going above and beyond the call of duty. But she further weaponized email by ensuring that every time someone gave her a verbal compliment, and you know, they liked to do that a lot, just give you a verbal compliment where there's no proof if things go south. So whenever someone gave her a verbal compliment and said she did something great, regardless of who they were, it didn't matter, as long as they worked at that campus or they were at the parent company, didn't matter who they were, she ran back to her desk and immediately sent them a thank you email, thanking them for the compliment that they just gave her, recognizing her for whatever it was that they complimented her on. That was super important because if they try to deny that she was performing at a stellar level, she had this email. And if they wanted to challenge her and say, you know, I never told you that, I never verbally complimented you, then the onus was on them to respond to her thank you email and say that. And people never did. Finally, she saved copies of her employment agreement, the employee handbook, a copy of Dave Brun's anti-discrimination policy, as well as a copy of her last paycheck stub. Because if things got bad and she needed to retain an attorney, she knew these things might come in handy, especially if the company decided to restrict her access, you know, cut it off, and she would already have these things in her arsenal. So with all of the weapons that she created in her arsenal, she felt a little better about her ability to fight back and survive the battle. Things were really great for a while, and Ebony thought that she had misjudged Dr. Taylor. But it was during Ebony's fourth and fifth years of employment, after her mother was diagnosed with what started out as stage 4 colon cancer, but it then became terminal cancer, that she realized her suspicions about Dr. Taylor were true. You see, Dr. Taylor used her mom's cancer diagnosis, as vicious as that was, as the spark to target Ebony at her most vulnerable moment and set her plan in motion to destroy Ebony's reputation, derail her career, take away her livelihood when she needed it the most, and replace Ebony with her white subordinate. Not because he was more qualified, but just because he was white. Dr. Taylor denied Ebony the authority of her position, prevented her from performing her duties that were associated with her job, assigned the duties that Ebony was performing to her white subordinate to carry out, and actively blocked promotion opportunities she had, as well as opportunities for growth. She conspired with other white leaders at the campus, including Ebony's own employee, to create a ruse and have Ebony falsely investigated for harassment. Dr. Taylor fostered a work environment that was so hostile that after only 6 months had passed, Ebony was completely stripped of all her dignity, of all her confidence, and of all her strength as she was on the verge of being fired. And these experiences took a toll on her health as she suffered emotional, physical, and mental racial trauma and considered both homicide and suicide. But again, even with all of that happening, Ebony was very smart. And as these horrific events were happening, she was meticulously documenting every single one in her daily log, as exhausted and as tired and as worn out as she was, as well as sending and saving emails that corroborated what was happening as tangible evidence along the way. Now, things came to a head with Ebony when she received a call from a coworker who was also her friend while she was away from the campus attending chemotherapy with her mother. The coworker informed her that HR was there at the campus and interviewing everyone, including Ebony's staff. And the buzz around the campus was that when Ebony returned to work the next day, she was going to be fired. And HR was going to make sure that they caught her when she originally arrived, because HR had traveled to that campus and had gotten a hotel overnight to get there first thing in the morning. Now, she's getting this information while her mom is in chemotherapy, fighting for her life, trying to survive what became terminal cancer. And the combined stress was too much for Ebony to handle. And so she suffered a mental breakdown and rushed to the doctor, who immediately put her on FMLA, which lasted for several weeks. During that time, she was approved for short-term disability, but more importantly, her job was safe because they couldn't fire her while she was on an approved medical leave. But I can't tell you how many people that I talked to as I was writing this book about their own horrific situations, how many people told me that when they had a mental breakdown too, because conditions were so severe, and they went on medical leave, when they came back, the racism picked right back up where it left off, and they were eventually wrongfully terminated. Ebony also had that fear. But she was also smart enough to know that they were still going to try to fire her when she returned, because they wanted her out of there. So while she was on medical leave, she did something bold that I can't think of a single person who's done something quite this bold. She put a wall of protection between her and Dr. Taylor, so that when she returned from her medical leave, they couldn't immediately fire her. So while she was on medical leave, she gathered all the email documentation that she had been collecting. She gathered her daily log, which had been meticulously kept up with all the details, dates, times, what happened, who was there. It was very, very detailed. And she took all of this evidence, put it in chronological order by date, renamed each piece of evidence, attachment one, attachment two, attachment three, and so on. And then using the information that she had kept in her daily log to jog her memory about everything that had happened to her over the last 5 years of her employment, both at the Austin campus and at the Temple campus, she drafted an ironclad discrimination complaint containing solid proof of racial discrimination. And because she had so much evidence, it actually took her about 7 hours to complete. And since she trusted absolutely no one in the Daybrun organization at the campus or otherwise, because she had suspicions that the reason her discrimination complaints kept falling on HR's deaf ears is because HR was in cahoots with the racists. After all, the racists are paying their salary. And so she didn't trust HR. She didn't trust the chancellor. She didn't trust anyone. She really didn't trust anybody at the parent company either. So she decided to send her discrimination complaint directly to the CEO of Daybrun's parent company. So she jumped over absolutely everybody's head, sent her a mountain of evidence and this ironclad, just beautifully written discrimination complaint to the parent company CEO. But because she didn't really trust that person either, she also did some more research, found the names of several board of director members, and copied them on the email that she sent to the CEO. Then, as one more hedge of protection around her, because she was absolutely determined that they were not going to fire her when she returned back to work the next day, she filed a formal racial discrimination complaint with the state of Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division. And then she retained an attorney. Now, as Ebony reflected back on the whirlwind of events that occurred with Dr. Taylor, she was amazed at how God used her friend at the Temple campus to give her heads up that she was going to be fired, that caused her mental breakdown at the chemotherapy clinic, and resulted in her medical leave of absence that stopped her from returning to work the next day and prevented her from being fired, and gave her the quiet time she needed to submit her formal written discrimination complaints to both the CEO of Daybrun's parent company and the Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division, which brought the government into the loop and finally gave Ebony the upper hand in her fight against racism in her workplace. Now, as the title of my book indicates, Ebony was able to successfully prove systemic racism in her workplace and keep her job. But there is so much more to the story that I just can't condense into a 30-minute slot. She received hush money to buy her silence in the form of a six-figure settlement, among a lot of other things, including another promotion. Now, some people may be wondering why Ebony chose to write this book the way she did, and not simply as a memoir to share her story. And, the answer is pretty simple. In most situations, when a company or someone pays you hush money to buy your silence, it's really because they know they have something to hide. And they're not going to turn over a six-figure settlement to you without getting some kind of guarantee that you're not going to still go out and tell the world what happened to you. So along with that hush money, they made her sign a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement, forbidding her to discuss what happened and putting her in a position where she could not write a memoir to tell her story. But as I keep telling you, Ebony was very smart. And she still found a way to tell her story and get her point across. Now, I began telling you when we started our talk that I wrote this book and started selling it from the trunk of my car 4 months ago because I really wanted to give hope to so many of us in our community who feel hopeless. And I'm so excited to tell you that today, Hush Money has over 100 reviews on Amazon with a 5-star rating. It's number one in best African-American women's fiction on Goodreads Listopia. It's number 8 in best African-American Christian fiction on findthisbest.com. And it was number 33 on Amazon's bestsellers list for Black and African-American Christian fiction last month. Hush Money is only $6. It's about what you pay for a cup of coffee. If you are someone who is currently dealing with racial discrimination and you need a survival guide to help you fight back. If you are an employer who wants to be able to identify those covert aspects of racism that I talked about in your organizations, or if you are someone who's never experienced racism, but you want to be an ally and you want to step into the shoes of Ebony to feel what racism and modern day racism looks like and feels like in a real and modern way, spend the $6 on Amazon, order my book, read the reviews. I promise you it will be the best $6 you ever spend. And I thank you for listening to me today.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.